This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thanks for staying with us here on The Morning Run. You're with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. 7:39 a.m. Wednesday, the 12th of August. And in about half an hour, we're having the breakfast grill where Wang Xiaoning will be speaking with Mohamed Razlan Jalaluddin, CEO of Education Malaysia Global Services.
Yeah, the task to promote Malaysia's education is entrusted to this company, Education Malaysia Global Services. They are under the purview of the Ministry of Higher Education. So I'm really curious, in the wake of COVID-19, where foreign students may opt not to come to Malaysia, how will Education Malaysia re-strategize to achieve its goals?
Well, to find out later on, tune in after the 8 o'clock news bulletin to the Breakfast Grill. But right now we are turning our attention stateside, because last weekend President Trump signed some memorandums and executive orders to provide temporary support to Americans suffering from the economic crisis brought on by COVID-19.
Some of these measures include a $400 weekly unemployment benefit, deferment of payroll taxes from September to December, and a direction to federal agencies to consider eviction prevention measures. There is also an extension of student loan relief granted by Congress in March through the end of the year.
So for more on this this morning, we're speaking with Catherine Dunn-Tenpas, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us. Now, how have these measures been received by both sides of the aisle, especially considering the Democrats are in favour of continuing more support measures?
I think that most people think that the executive order is not sufficient. Some of the executive orders, if you sort of read them a little bit more carefully, they require the cooperation of governors. They require states to contribute as well as the federal government. So I think that President Trump has a tendency to make it sound like it's the same thing as legislation, but it's actually a far cry. And it's really not going to be, it's not designed and it's not able to fulfill the needs of the many people who are unemployed and are hurting because of the COVID-19. I think that he likes to think he can do everything by executive order, but if that were the case, there would be no reason to ever have a Congress. So clearly this is sort of, you know, it's a measure he can take, but it's not nearly sufficient at this point in time.
Would you say this executive order is unconstitutional then, that it overreaches a Congress?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. There are some constitutional scholars who are questioning a couple of the executive orders. It'll take quite a while, though, for those to get to the courts, to get challenged, and then for the judges to decide. But that's been the case since the beginning. When he first started office, you might remember he had the immigration executive order that caused quite a stir and was also proven to be unconstitutional. He tends to work quickly. He acts impulsively and makes decisions that require his staff to assemble these executive orders in a very short time period. And as a result, many of them have gotten overturned by the courts.
Now, executive order overreach was a point of contention from the Republicans during the Obama administration, because Barack Obama took to executive orders for many of his policies then. Do you see parallels here? And is it a bit, is there a sense of hypocrisy?
There absolutely is. I think that President Trump is counting on most people having a very short memory. But if you look at some of the clips from the 2016 campaign, you can see President Trump criticizing President Obama for governing through executive orders. And that's exactly what he's doing now.
And so, Catherine, Congress has yet to reach an agreement on a new stimulus package. I mean, since both Republicans and Democrats are at odds about its size, amongst other things, do you see them reaching a consensus soon? What might a compromise look like?
Oh, I'm not sure they're going to reach a consensus soon. I think that Democrats are standing firm on their demands, and I think the Republicans think that they're asking for too much. So I think it will be hard to come to a compromise. I think there is always the possibility that if there's enough public outcry, that maybe they will come back to the table and compromise. But I think at this point, it's to the Democrats' advantage to kind of have this stalemate and to show that they're really fighting for more for the working people and that the Republicans are not willing to acquiesce. So everybody knows that there's an election in less than 100 days. And I think a lot of the behavior right now is highly motivated with that election in mind.
Catherine, what are some of those hurdles that the Democrats are standing by right now?
Well, I think it's mostly disagreements about the size and scope of the aid. And I think even though Republicans have had tax cuts and they've added a lot to the federal deficit, they worry that right now there are some disincentives. For instance, you can get $600 a week from the federal government during this crisis. And they worry that that's a disincentive for people to work, that some people can get more money by collecting the assistance than they can by holding a job. The Democrats say, no, that's not the case. Many of these people have families. Many of these people are having trouble getting to work. They've lost their jobs. It's really not too much money. And so the president has agreed in the executive order to give individuals $400 instead of $600. But I think that the Democrats are trying to stand firm.
Well, the big news this morning is that Joe Biden has tapped Kamala Harris to be his running mate, and she's the first African-American vice presidential nominee from either major party. How do you think this will affect his candidacy?
Well, it's interesting. I think that most people in the United States vote for the president and not for the vice president. However, I think that if you pick somebody who is easily criticized, for example, Sarah Palin back in 2008, I think it can draw attention to your judgment and it can sort of cause people not to vote for you. So you might have heard the expression, do no harm. I think that that's probably the best advice for presidential candidates when selecting their vice president. Pick somebody that's really not easy to criticize. I think Kamala Harris was a safe choice for the Biden campaign. I would say the only drawback that I can think of is that she does not come from a swing state. She comes from a pretty solid Democratic state of California. And had she been from, you know, Arizona or Wisconsin or Michigan, I think that could have brought even greater benefit to the Biden campaign. But having said that, I think it's important that he has a woman and a woman of color. And I think that she's highly respected. And it's hard. The early statements out of the Trump campaign and from the president, they seem to be having a difficult time criticizing her.
Thank you so much for speaking with us this morning, Catherine. That was Catherine Dantanpas of the Brookings Institute speaking to us from Washington. And I think she made an interesting point there at the end, talking about Kamala Harris and the fact that she is from a Democrat stronghold, because a lot of Joe Biden's other choices could have come from, like, Val Demings was also on the cards, right? So she's from Florida, which is not a strong state for the Democrats. So that might have been able to bring them, you know, at least one more on the cards in terms of the Electoral College. But I guess, you know, he's made his choice. And it's true that Kamala Harris has got a pretty solid reputation. So I guess it does remain to be seen what President Donald Trump's campaign will be able to do.
Yeah, her feel is that this is a do no harm strategy. But I think, it may enhance his chances of becoming president. Some of the things that she supports, healthcare reforms, registering undocumented migrants, supporting the DREAM Act, as well as a ban on assault weapons.
Yeah, but a lot of times the VP pick is tactical, right? You take them mm-hmm. from a swing state because you want to galvanize the voters there. She's from California, but she's a woman of color. So it is, it's going to be an interesting pick. If she had been from a swing state, I think that would have been the incredible sweet spot, but you can't have everything.
All right, and now we are about to head into some messages. And then up next, we're going to be turning our attention to political developments on a more local front. So the latest out of East Malaysia with comments from James Chin, of the University of Tasmania. So be sure to stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.